Today is Thursday, June 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, the Democratic candidates for president have completed their first round of debates.
I will fight for you as hard as I fight for my own family.
We have a wrap of day one and a preview of tonight's second round. Also, the group of 20 congregates in Japan, where U.S. President Donald Trump is expected to have several bilateral meetings. And reports that North Korea has detained an Australian college student. Those stories are coming up ahead on today's International Edition. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has this recap of day one of the Democratic presidential candidate debates in Miami, Florida.
On stage in Miami, 10 Democrats vying for the right to challenge President Trump next year in a nationally televised debate hosted by NBC. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's been rising in the polls of late, focused on the economic divide in the United States.
I am in this fight because I believe that we can make our government, we can make our economy, we can make our country work, not just for those at the top. We can make it work for everyone, and I promise you this. I will fight for you as hard as I fight for my own family.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio crafted his appeal to working-class voters.
Because putting working people first, it matters. We need to be that party again.
But Ohio Representative Tim Ryan said national Democrats were out of touch.
We are not connecting to the working-class people in the very states that I represent, in Ohio, in the industrial Midwest. We've lost all connection.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker argued he was the best candidate to defeat President Trump next year.
This is a referendum on him and getting rid of him, but it's also a referendum on us, who we are and who we must be to each other.
Immigration was a flashpoint in the debate. Former Cabinet Secretary Julian Castro lashed out at Trump administration policies in the wake of the drowning deaths of a father and daughter from El Salvador and the haunting photos that have drawn international attention.
Watching that image of Oscar and his daughter Valeria is heartbreaking. It should also piss us all off.
Former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke joined in the condemnation.
We would not turn back Valeria and her father, Oscar. We would accept them into this country and follow our own asylum laws. We would not build walls. We would not put kids in cages.
The candidates were also asked about recent tensions with Iran. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar said she feared that President Trump was moving the country closer to war.
And this president is literally every single day 10 minutes away from going to war, one tweet away from going to war, and I don't think we should conduct foreign policy in our bathrobe at 5 in the morning.
There was also a debate over whether the U.S. should stay in Afghanistan. Ohio Representative Tim Ryan said yes.
And the lesson that I've learned over the years is that you have to stay engaged in these situations.
But Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard said it was time for the United States to leave.
As a soldier, I will tell you that answer is unacceptable. We have to bring our troops home from Afghanistan. We are in a place in Afghanistan where we have lost so many lives.
Also taking part in the Wednesday debate were former Maryland Representative John Delaney and Washington Governor Jay Inslee. On Thursday, 10 more Democratic contenders will get their first chance to debate. They include Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, California Senator Kamala Harris, and the current frontrunner, former Vice President Joe Biden. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Now, in response to the first night of debates, the Trump campaign released a statement critiquing the event that read in part, "This debate was the best argument for President Trump's re-election and should really be counted as an in-kind contribution to the president's campaign. The Democrats proposed a radical government takeover of American society that would demolish the American dream so many are gaining access to under the growing Trump economy." A second debate is scheduled for tonight, featuring 10 more of the Democratic candidates, as Jim Malone said. And to take a look at that forthcoming debate, I'd like to welcome back to the program from Miami, Florida, VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Hello, Catherine. Catherine, are you there?
I am there. Hello, Steve.
It's great to have you back on the program. So we know that we have 10 more candidates, including frontrunner former Vice President Joe Biden. We have Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. And we have, of course, some of the other key figures in the Democratic contingency out there. What are they saying as they're going into tonight's debate?
You know, what we're really looking at here in Miami is kind of a win-loss from last night. And really, the big winner here in Florida was Castro, who really was able to nail down on some of the details of his immigration proposals, which I can tell you really resonates here in diverse Miami and diverse Florida. I actually watched the debate last night with a group of women of color, African Americans and Latinas, who are saying that, well, this upcoming election is a referendum on President Donald Trump. They want to hear more from these Democratic candidates. It's not enough for Joe Biden to say that he can go up against President Trump in a general election. He needs to present detailed, concrete policy proposals that will appeal to them and address the issues in their own lives.
When taking a look at what happened last night, we had 10 candidates on stage. We have 10 more tonight. The responses were really drilled down, really specific, really short. Do the candidates feel they have ample opportunity to express their viewpoints in this condensed format?
I think the sense that everyone took away from the debate last night is that there are really too many contenders in the Democratic presidential field, and that we really noticed that last night on stage. There wasn't a lot of time for everybody to respond. There wasn't a lot of debate. There was that one instance later on in the debate when each candidate was asked for their one-word response about the greatest foreign policy threat worldwide. That's not enough time to really drill down on these details. So I think that in coming debates, as some of the candidates drop out, we'll actually be able to see a little bit more detail, a little bit more content.
And we should also mention there were six other candidates who didn't meet the minimum requirements to even participate in this round. So we have a field of 26. Hopefully they'll be able to whittle that down moving forward as we move into some of the primaries. But what are candidates saying that they want to do after this first series of debates?
Well, obviously, they'll get back out on the campaign trail, and we also have a lot of candidates who are still serving in the U.S. Senate, the U.S. Congress, so many of them will need to get back to Washington, D.C. and Capitol Hill. But really, Steve, this is just the very first part of a 16-month-long process, so we're going to be seeing those candidates out on the campaign trail in some of the key early election states, reaching out to voters there.
Thank you, Catherine. Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent, and she is at the debates in Miami. Wednesday, the U.S. Senate approved bipartisan legislation to address the humanitarian crisis along the U.S.-Mexico border with more than $4 billion in supplemental funds and new requirements for the care of detained migrants, especially children. The 84-8 vote comes amid renewed scrutiny of the Trump administration's treatment of minors in its custody and amid widespread revulsion over the deaths of a father and daughter from El Salvador who perished trying to cross the Rio Grande River into the United States. To reach President Donald Trump's desk, the Senate bill would need to pass the House, but the majority Democrats in the House signal they want to change the bill and plan to introduce those changes today. Here are some other major stories from around the globe. A German humanitarian ship carrying 42 migrants rescued off the coast of Libya has reached Italian waters. The ship spent 2 weeks in open seas when no European country would accept it. At least 15 people were killed and 75 wounded in a stampede at a stadium after a military parade in Madagascar's capital Wednesday to mark the country's Independence Day. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro said Wednesday security forces foiled an opposition coup attempt that included plans to assassinate him and other top political figures and install a jailed former military officer as president. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOANews.com website and with our mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers at the University of Nottingham, England, conducted a new study that suggests coffee could become an effective weapon in the battle against obesity. It turns out we actually have two kinds of fat, white or bad fat, the stuff we try to shed, and brown adipose tissue, also known as brown or good fat. Scientists say this good fat uses the bad fat, along with sugar, as fuel to burn calories and produce heat. Along with a number of other positive benefits, the heat produced by the brown fat also helps to keep us warm when it's cold. To make their findings, the researchers had their test subjects drink a cup of coffee. Soon after, they thermally imaged areas of the volunteers' bodies where the good fat is stored and found the coffee did help stimulate the brown fat to produce calorie and body fat burning heat. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. World leaders are heading to the Japanese city of Osaka for this year's G20 summit, which starts on Friday. The G20 is aimed at promoting financial stability and sustainability. As Henry Ridgewell reports, many of its members have sharply differing views on issues like trade and climate change.
As the world's top 20 economies prepare to gather in Osaka, all eyes are on its two biggest members, the United States and China. U.S. tariff hikes on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods has led to a spiraling trade war threatening the global economy. But in recent days, bilateral talks have resumed and the language has softened, raising hopes of a breakthrough, says analyst John Curtin, who is at the summit in Osaka.
Everyone's is awaiting the bilateral meeting on the margins of the summit between President Trump and President Xi. But behind that drama, there will be many meaningful advances on a range of issues. And there are overlapping coalitions of countries that are pushing them forward in a spirit of compromise.
Summit host Shinzo Abe made his hopes clear this week.
I expect that the United States and China will resolve their trade friction in a constructive manner through dialogue.
The Osaka meeting could see significant progress, says Curtin.
This trade war is taking place at a time when the global economy is in pretty good shape. And there's major agreement about to arrive at Osaka on trade liberalization and new rules for the new high frontier of trade in the 21st century, digital trade.
Yet other shadows hang over the summit. The threat of conflict between the United States and Iran has driven up oil prices. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy protests have received vocal support from the West, though China insists it will not allow the demonstrations onto the G20 agenda. The biggest dispute could come over climate change.
And here there's a natural tendency for the host, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, to put that on the back burner, so the spirit of compromise, agreement, and harmony will prevail. But we have no time to lose at the control of a climate crisis.
France says it will insist the summit communique backs strong action on climate change.
I have one red line. If we don't go far enough with our climate ambitions, that means we're holding the meeting for nothing.
Analysts say the G20 meeting will be seen as a test of multilateralism at a time of huge challenges for the international community. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The Wall Street Journal reports Chinese President Xi Jinping plans to present U.S. President Donald Trump with a set of terms the United States should meet before Beijing is ready to settle their trade dispute. While at the G20, Beijing insists that the U.S. remove its ban on the sale of U.S. technology to Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei, according to the journal, citing Chinese officials with knowledge of the plan. The business newspaper also says Beijing wants the U.S. to lift all punitive tariffs and drop efforts to get China to buy even more U.S. exports than Beijing said it would when the two leaders met in December. Australian government officials are urgently seeking to confirm whether one of its citizens has been detained in North Korea. Phil Mercer reports.
The family of Alex Sigley, an Australian student living in Pyongyang, say they haven't heard from him for 48 hours, which is unusual. Active on social media, he doesn't appear to have logged into his Twitter or Facebook accounts for several days. It's not known why Sigley, an Asian scholar and fluent Korean speaker, might have been detained. He's thought to be the only Australian living in North Korea. His family can't confirm if he's been arrested, but Australian government officials say it's a very serious set of circumstances. Originally from Perth in Western Australia, the 29-year-old has been living in the North Korean capital for the past year while studying Korean literature at Kim Il-sung University. He's also run a business running tours for Western tourists visiting the totalitarian and impoverished North Korean state. Professor John McKay is a Korea expert from Deakin University.
The North Koreans are incredibly sensitive to what we would regard as the smallest provocation. For example, a few years ago there was a huge diplomatic incident between South Korea and North Korea when one of the South Korean workers in the special economic zone just over the border in North Korea was seen wrapping some garbage in a North Korean newspaper, and the newspaper had a picture of the North Korean leader on it. The North Koreans reacted very sharply to that, what they saw as a provocation.
Several foreigners have previously been detained in North Korea, sometimes for illegal entry or for what the regime considers to be hostile criminal acts against the state. In 2016, an American student, Otto Warmbier, was jailed in North Korea for stealing a propaganda sign during a tour. He spent 17 months behind bars and later died days after he was returned to the United States in a coma. Australia's official travel advice to North Korea is that there's a high level of risk and potential travellers should reconsider their need to visit the country. Foreign visitors have been subject to arbitrary arrest and long-term detention, it adds. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. President Donald Trump insists his North Korea policy is doing great ahead of his visit to Seoul later this week. And South Korean President Moon Jae-in says talks with Pyongyang are making steady progress. But a statement carried by the Korean Central News Agency warns there is no guarantee negotiations will resume. The article also reiterates North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's end-of-the-year deadline for the United States to change its approach to nuclear talks. You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Thanks for listening to Border Crossings with Larry London. We're honoring Avicii, one of EDM's greatest producers, who tragically passed away last year, with a month-long giveaway of his new album, Tim. The album includes vocals from many prominent artists, including Chris Martin and more. Tune in at 1500 Universal every weekday in June for your chance to win a free copy of Tim. Anyone who makes a request has a chance to win.
Border Crossings!
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Two suicide bombers blew themselves up in separate attacks on police in the Tunisian capital today, killing one police officer and wounding several other people, according to the government. It is not known who was behind the attacks, which comes months before an election and at the peak of a tourist season in which Tunisia is hoping for a record number of visitors. In addition, officials say 92-year-old President Beji Kate Al-Sibsi, was taken to a military hospital after suffering severe health crisis. One of his advisors told Reuters news agency he is in very critical condition, but is alive, denying media reports that he has passed away. Forces allied to Libya's internationally recognized government seized the town of Harayan, south of Tripoli, home to the main supply base of Eastern forces attacking the capital. The takeover of Harayan by Tripoli forces is considered a major blow to the Libya National Army. Khalifa Haftar heads the force, which is based in the east, and on April 4th, it started an offensive to take Tripoli from the internationally recognized government of National Accord. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the Libya Analysis website in London, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about this development in the battle for Tripoli.
It was quite a surprising move. It's really very significant, or has the potential to be very significant, if the GNA aligned forces can hold on to it. They appear to be at the moment, but this could change in the coming hours and days. It's very important for the LNA because, as you mentioned, it is their main support base. Most of their army, their supplies, are in the east of the country. And Harayan, which is about an hour south of Tripoli, has been the main route that they've been bringing in both additional forces, but also weapons, supplies, food, fuel, all of that type of thing. If they're cut off from there, they will have just one town left in the kind of west of Tripoli that they will be able to use as a base. And as a result, they could be increasingly isolated. Their kind of momentum is likely to be dented, and they could have real issues trying to sustain the fight and keep that kind of siege on Tripoli.
The Libyan National Army still holds the town of Tarhuna, southeast of Tripoli, which is its second main position in this campaign. What would happen if the GNA forces managed to take over Tarhuna as well?
If that happens, then the LNA would be in a very difficult position indeed. Without Harayan, Tarhuna, as you say, is the second base. And again, this is where they've been using the kind of point to launch their attacks, their airstrikes and others against Tripoli. Whether Tarhuna, whether they will lose it or not, it remains to be seen. But I think a key element in this, and I think also will be the case in Harayan, is what the local population think and if they change their mind. So far, a lot of the people in Tarhuna have supported the LNA, but if it looks increasingly like the LNA are going to lose or they can't sustain their kind of offensive on the capital, then we may see more of the local population either switching sides or being more willing to enter into some kind of peace negotiation or ceasefire.
Could the takeover of Tarhuna by the government of National Accord's forces positively or negatively impact the efforts to reach a ceasefire and then start a negotiated political solution in Libya?
So I think from one angle, it could be positive, as I say, if the GNA forces are able to kind of overcome the LNA and also drive them out of Tarhuna, mainly because that will give, you know, the conditions that the GNA Prime Minister Sarraj has said is that the LNA must go back to its positions before April. So in theory, that would provide more of a platform. But equally, the Westerners have said they won't negotiate with Haftar, which is likely to be another red line for the kind of Eastern faction. So although it will certainly be a change, and I think that in some ways will be positive because it gives new angles, new opportunities for kind of peace talks to take place, the danger, however, is that Haftar, you know, will refuse to negotiate, will not see it being in his best interest to negotiate in any form. And that may then lead to more drastic action, which the LNA does have access to, it does have supply routes to. So I think a lot will remain to be seen whether this could be a positive step and a chance to open up negotiations or whether it'll be a kind of shift to a more drastic phase. Or desperate phase, I suppose, of the conflict.
And that was Rhiannon Smith with Libby Analysis in London, speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that's going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and engineer, Sidrock, thank you so much for joining us. Now, for pictures, video stories, and more, be sure to follow The Voice of America on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a terrific Thursday.